Right now it is time to join our friends from the Berkshire Edge, theberkshireedge.com, available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with news stories for you covering South County and surrounding areas. And on a Wednesday morning, we're joined by both David and Marcy. Good morning, guys. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
And congratulations to you folks. You have another pot shop that's opening on Friday in Greybury.
I know, you know. It's an embarrassment of riches, you know.
Is this the third one that's open now or fourth?
Oh, no, I think it's the sixth. Let's see.
More pot per capita.
Yeah, I think it's the sixth.
You know, it's amazing, isn't it?
Well, you know what? Kind of like the gold rush back in the old days.
I guess so.
I guess it is, but there must be a huge demand.
I would say so. I mean, there's more. You have more pot shops than you have Chinese restaurants.
Oh, yes.
Indeed.
We do.
That's true. You know, that's the Berkshires for you.
Yep. Well. All right. Well, let's go to the let's get off the weed and get on the beat. Your first story that we'll talk about.
Off the weed and onto the reed.
Yeah, right. That's right. The Stockbridge Library has a discussion coming up with a former Boston Globe editor.
Yeah, Marty Baron.
Yes,
he was there. Go ahead, Marcy.
No. I attended also. So, you know, Marty Baron is a real star in the. in the journalism world.
Yeah.
If you remember the movie Spotlight.
Yep.
About the Spotlight investigative team at the Boston Globe that investigated the Catholic Church for child abuse, for Catholic priests in Boston for child abuse, and Marty Baron was played by Liev Schreiber. he was head of that Spotlight team and at the Boston Globe, and then he became the editor in chief of the Washington Post, and he retired to Stockbridge. So he now lives here.
That's where all newspaper editors live.
<That's right. laughs>
So he now lives here, and there was a conversation with him at the Stockbridge Library on Saturday, which was extremely well attended. It's very interesting to see how many people came out to hear him. It was standing room only, and they had a big room. So he was very interesting, talking about censorship. You know, the conversation began about censorship, about why is it that people are censoring books? That so many books are being put on a list that can't be taught in classrooms or can't be available in schools, classrooms, or libraries. Then, of course, went on to talk about the state of journalism how journalists are surviving in this age of new media and 24/7 news coverage. He's very wise and he's very articulate, and he has certainly lots of experience. He did say that in 10 years there will probably be no print newspapers, which is not surprising. And luckily, we don't have one, so it doesn't bother us.
It is a troublesome.
It is a troublesome.
Yeah.
Yes, especially since I get the New York Times delivered in paper every day.
Not only that, the print newspaper has a financial model that's I think a little bit more robust than the
online. As we can attest.
That's right.
Right.
Well, it does. In a national sense, I think, but I think what's happening in a local sense, which I think you guys were wise to start off when you did and how you did, is that the advertising market around our tri-state region, which includes South County, Massachusetts, adjacent Eastern New York, and Northwest Connecticut, it's totally different now since we've not only, first we had the incursion of big box stores, then we had the incursion of Walmarts and Costco's and things like that, and now you have Amazon and other outlets like that. So especially in smaller towns, it's going to be more and more important for people like you to be entrepreneurial enough to put out a paper, whether it's online or actually on paper, because and this is where in small town government, where if you don't get the news and know the news what's coming up in advance, how informed can you be and how active can you be in your community?
That's right. And in New England, of course, we have a very participatory form of local government too, where we have town meetings, and not every region has that, you know, that form of public participation and reliance on public participation, you know. So you're right. We'll have to see how this shakes out, but this is fragile times, you might say.
Yeah.
And I know in this talk that they're going to talk about cancel culture, and I learned very early in my life. I was very lucky. I had some great broadcast teachers. My first real program director, John Petodier, I did something on the air. Somebody local had posed in back then a magazine which was a Penthouse, okay? And so I was doing traffic reports, and I found out where they lived, and so I flew over the house and said, you know, I talked about the person. So they came into the station and threatened to sue, and right in front of my program director spoke for me and just said, make sure you spell his name right. It's Marshall Miles, two L's on the Marshall, one L. He said, because your client opened the door, first of all, not only by posing and doing it, but also distributing copies in a local area. So make sure you spelled his name right. You know, he was very good at weeding out people that wanted to use threaten an economic boycott. And the cancel culture, I hope, is a big part of the talk, because it's something that we all, as journalists and as broadcasters and whatever, teachers, whatever, have to deal with. People, you know, you can't cancel everything because you disagree with something.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, he said that also.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hello? Yeah.
It's, you know,
I'm here. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the more people hear that and understand that this cancel culture business, no matter whether it's Republicans, Democrats, Independents, red, white, blue, or, you know, you can disagree with somebody's opinions, and if they're really outlandish opinions, you can complain about them, but to go out and cancel somebody, it's ludicrous, and that's the changing face of the way people react to journalism.
Well, the other thing that he said that I thought was particularly interesting was he said, you know, that now that journalists are being encouraged to be on social media, and they are, you know, I know journalists who work for big papers who are, you know, not only do they now file their stories for the paper, but they are encouraged to develop a big social media following as well. What Marty Baron was saying was that you have to still remember that you're a journalist, because what happens when you're on social media is that journalists tend to think that they should be expressing their own opinions. And he said you can't do that. You either have to be an activist or you have to be a journalist, but you can't be both. I mean, a journalist doesn't express his or her opinion.
That's exactly right.
A journalist reports on the news, and if you're using social media also to, you know, to express your own opinion while you're writing, you know, which is something that's supposed to be a straightforward report, then you make a mess, and you lose your credibility, and you're no longer a journalist. So he was saying, you know, very clearly, and I think our article quoted that. He said, "You're either a journalist. You know, if you want to be a journalist, be a journalist. If you want to be an advocate, he says." And if you want to be an activist, be an activist. If you want to be a politician, be a politician. But if you choose to be a news reporter, act like one.
Yep.
So I think that is, you know, that was one of the most important things that I took away from him, that journalists have to remember what their job is.
All right, I want to move on. Speaking about journalists and jobs, whenever you think about the village of Housatonic, you think of waterworks, but this story isn't about that. It's about.
Also reported in the village of Housatonic that they did a, at Christmas time or the holiday time, they lit up the streets. And now they've done it again in solidarity with Ukraine.
Yeah. They lit up the elementary school building that's no longer a school, but
right.
It's in the center, just in the center of town. It overlooks the village, posing on a, it's on a big hill overlooking the, right in the center of the village, and they lit up the windows in the colors of Ukraine to express solidarity with the Ukrainians.
Right.
And so it was quite dramatic.
Yes. There's a man in Housatonic named Eric Gabriel, who's a select board member, and he's also a licensed electrician. And so he played a key role in bringing lights to the school building during the Christmas time, and now the lights have changed color. They were green and red at Christmas time, and now they're blue and yellow. We have nice pictures of it too. It's an encouraging sign.
You know, across the line in New York State, over the past week, two local fundraisers were held for Ukraine, and those local fundraisers raised, get this, over $125,000.
Oh my gosh.
125, which went right to 501c3 charities, which once the money's given to them within 3 days, it's transferred to the Polish border with Ukraine, and within 4 days is helping people in the Ukraine. So that's just another one of the stories that goes along how this area recognizes what's going on in Ukraine, whether it's showing support or
really. And responded so quickly.
Yeah.
It's amazing that we identified so quickly with those poor people,
Right.
Yeah. We'll go on to your next story. Lisa Donovan from the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, an idea of coming up with a way to integrate arts into a traditional education curriculum.
Yes, this is her. She's a MCLA professor, and her idea is to integrate the arts into the instruction for elementary school kids, and it's an interesting idea. And in any case, we have a long story about her and how this works in the curriculum. And her idea is that the students learn as better in a way when their education is integrated with storytelling and poetry and music and visual arts,
and
creative movement.
Right.
Yeah. So it's an interesting proposition.
She gives strategies with model lessons,
right.
Which show teachers how to do this.
Yeah.
And teachers, have been picking it up, all over the country.
Yeah.
So this is very interesting.
So she's an innovator.
Yes.
An education innovator. And so this is...
She leads a couple of organizations, the Creative Compact for Collective and Collaborative Impact.
Right.
But also the Berkshire Cultural Asset Network. So that she is working with schools and around Berkshire County to show teachers how to integrate the arts into their curriculum. Very interesting.
Well, it is, and the Berkshires are known for they're performing arts and visual arts, opportunities here.
Right.
So it makes sense that this local schools should just take advantage of this.
Yeah, and she says, I mean, we are so ideally placed in the Berkshires. I mean, we have such extraordinary cultural assets here in the Berkshires, and that, you know, the schools are not making enough use of them, and they're not integrating them sufficiently. So the kids who are being educated in Berkshire County don't really know, you know, they don't know what they have here, and they don't know how to appreciate it, and they are not visiting it or using it.
Yeah, I mean, we have, you know, for example, Mass MoCA in North Adams is a world-class museum, and with not only exhibits that are astonishing, but also, creative activities and performing arts events. So, it makes sense for the schools here to take advantage of that. And, you know, what's great about this is that these institutions here are open to this idea.
Yes, right.
Which is also an advantage.
Right.
Well, you know,
and she just one last thing. I mean, she has recently set up a new website for local educators that they can go to and learn the strategies free of charge. It's called the Canvas Portal, and it's worth 10 professional development points also if teachers go to do it. And Peter Dillon, who's the superintendent of the Berkshire Hills Regional School District, is backing this as well. So so this is very interesting.
You know, there's been forays into this. I mean, you look at Shakespeare and Company, the way they deal with schools.
That's
and and also here in Region 1 many, many years ago, Region 1 Arts Fund was formed, and one of the first things they did is, with the cooperation with Hotchkiss School, there's a Region 1 Arts Day for elementary school students where the students spend a whole day sampling and listening to and participating in just about every form of art there is. And all those things really do open up the creative juices for young children and students to be exposed to something that all it takes is that one little exposure where they can get hooked on it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I think the more that the curriculums do that and open up and allow things like this in it, the better it'll be.
Well, yes. I mean, and this is a very strong movement. I when I lived in New York, I was on the board of something called Outward Bound, New York City Outward Bound Schools, where Outward Bound, you know, which is known for taking people out into the wilderness to teach them skills and to make them go beyond where they think they can go, has developed a curriculum for teaching, which, you know, is much more hands-on and uses all the principles of Outward Bound, but in the curriculum. And so this was also, you know, getting kids, I mean, they say, this, you know, no more chalk and talk, which is what education used to be, but kids have to be very participatory now, and the curricula have to really be integrated. I mean, you can't, you know, you have to integrate math with history, and, you know, one of the things that the Outward Bound Center did in its school and its teaching was things like taking the kids to the Brooklyn Bridge and having them measure the Brooklyn Bridge, and also investigate who lived on either side of the bridge, and also learn the history of the bridge. So this was an integration of math and history and social studies, and, you know, very active. And the kids went out to the neighborhoods and talked to people about, you know, who lived on either side of the Brooklyn Bridge. So it was, you know, it's that kind of thing, and it's very exciting that these kinds of things are happening in education.
Okay, about
well, also, you know, Mass MoCA is very, its management has also been very open to this idea of integrating its astonishing collection into the community. So we're blessed with that. That we have institutions that are, you know, that are willing to participate in this
right.
way.
And, you know, and man, they're all doing that. The Mount has a writer's workshop that reports to the community. Simon's Rock has a residencies in coordination with the James Weldon Johnson Foundation, who he was a Harlem Renaissance writer who lived in Great Barrington. Many of them are doing.
And Shakespeare and Company does its annual high school kids put on a Shakespeare play.
Yeah.
So
and the Norman Rockwell Museum has essay contests about the Four Freedoms, you know, that kids can participate in. So it's not like there was nothing here before, but this is to encourage it to be not just, you know, generated by the museums, but also have it come from the teachers and be integrated on a daily basis into what kids do. So it's very promising.
All right, I want to go on because we only have about 3.5 minutes left. And next story very quickly. I guess enough is enough. The selectman in West Oxford just resigned.
Yes, he did. And he wasn't. He hadn't been in that long. He was. He was elected 2 years ago. This is Roger Cavanaugh, who was first elected to the West Stockbridge Select Board just 2 years ago. He resigned, and he said, you know, that the town's divisions are debilitating.
And self-destructive, right?
Right.
So this is the first time I've heard of a select board member kind of like calling out the kind of intrinsic and embedded and contentious disagreements in the town. And, you know, he was a well-respected member of the select board.
Yeah.
So this is not...
By all sides, political stripes. Yeah. So he just and you know they had a big fight last year about we reported on access to there's a performance space that was doing outdoor concerts and on its own land and somebody it was called the Foundry and it's a performance venue and you know there was a restaurant that claimed that it was cutting off access to the restaurant and making too much noise, and so this really split the town. And he's saying, you know, that he doesn't, you know, it's becoming impossible to govern.
All right, we only have about a minute and a half left, and because I did the interview right before we came on with you about the Berkshire Opera Festival, let's get to the story because they have an event coming up. On the 27th on Sunday.
Right. On Sunday, right at
St. James Place.
Yes. Right. So we are covering the same thing, and they are advertising with us, and their event is also on our calendar. I noticed that you mentioned that it's on your website as well. We have an online calendar, and it's on our online calendar as well.
And this is just an addition to what their regular season is going to be as they appear at different venues. But once again, the arts is alive and well, and everything's coming to life this year in spite of COVID with the arrival of spring.
Right. We really need it.
Yes.
Full disclosure, I am the chair of the board of a concert series called Close Encounters with Music, and we had a concert last Sunday at the Mahaley. And it was live again, and people were thrilled.
Yep.
We have been doing concerts on Zoom for the last year and a half, but we had this fabulous pianist who was a Van Cliburn International Competition winner, and to be able to sit there in the audience and watch his fingers move, it was extraordinary. You can't really get that. You don't have that same feeling when you're watching it on Zoom.
And you can also feel the music when you're there live.
Yeah,
you can feel it. Not only hear it, but you can feel it, and that just makes all the difference in the world. It really does.
And the performers you know, feel so much better when they have an audience.
Yep, absolutely.
That's, I mean, they, you know, they all said that, that, you know, they, you know, it's one thing to play to an empty hall, but to have an audience there applauding and, you know, it makes them perform better.
All right. Well, that's coming up this Sunday, but we're out of time.
Yes.
I will speak to you guys next week.
Okay.
Okay, Michael.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That is the Berkshire Edge on air. You can find them, of course, theberkshireedge.com.